With Malcolm separated from the family, and Wilfred and Hilda struggling to support the rest of their siblings after their mother's institutionalization, help arrived from Boston in late 1939 or early 1940 in the form of Ella Little, their oldest half-sister. One of Earl's children from his first marriage, Ella had moved north from Georgia with other family members in the 1930s. Though she had never met, or at least had never been much involved with, Earl's second family, when news reached her of their troubles in Lansing, she set out to take an active role in the children's supervision. To the 15-year-old Malcolm, she was an assertive, no-nonsense woman. During Ella's visit, the little children accompanied her to Kalamazoo to call on their mother. Malcolm was particularly affected by the physical differences between the two women. Ella's jet-black skin and robust physique provided a striking contrast to Louise's much lighter complexion. Several days later, just prior to her return home, Ella urged Malcolm to write to her regularly. Perhaps, she ventured, he might even spend part of the summer with her in Boston. "I jumped at the chance," Malcolm recalled. When Malcolm made the trip in the summer of 1940, he was overwhelmed by the city's sights. Ella was only 26, but seemed worldly and independent. She lived with her second husband in a comfortable single-family home on Wambeck Street, in the racially mixed Hill District of Boston. Her younger brother, Earl Jr., and her shy younger sister, Mary, resided there as well. On the weekends, thousands of blacks congregated in Boston's busy streets, shopping, going to restaurants or movies. For the first time in his life, Malcolm saw black-white couples walking together easily, without obvious fear. He was fascinated by the sounds and rhythms of jazz, which poured forth from clubs like Wally's Paradise and the Savoy Cafe, along Massachusetts Avenue between Columbus and Huntington Avenues. It was a thrilling world, a lively, urban environment, and its magic took hold of his imagination in a lasting way. When he returned home that fall, he made some efforts to readjust to small-town life. Despite his physical awkwardness, he tried out for and made Mason's football team. Over two decades later, a local newspaper published a photograph of Mason's 1940 squad, which included Malcolm. The paper claimed that he showed a preference for tackling ball carriers instead of tackling the white race as he is doing today. When Malcolm went to Mason, you could see a change in him, Wilfred recalled. Some for the better, some for the worse. He would complain about some of the things the teachers would try to do. They would try to discourage him from taking courses that black people weren't supposed to take. In other words, keep him in his place. It hadn't bothered him particularly during the previous year when white students who had befriended him continued to call him nigger. But now Malcolm was keenly aware of the social distance between himself and others. An English teacher, Richard Kaminska, sharply discouraged him from becoming a lawyer. "You've got to be realistic about being a nigger," Kaminska advised him. "A lawyer? That's no realistic goal for a nigger. Why don't you plan on carpentry?" Malcolm's grades plummeted, and his truculence increased. Within several months, he found himself expelled. Already burdened by the demands of a large family, Wilfred and Hilda soon found they could not handle their wayward younger brother. Once again, Ella felt compelled to intervene. Several months earlier, in a letter to Malcolm, she had written, "We miss you so much. Don't swell up and bust, but honest, everything seems dead here. Lots of boys called for you. I would like for you to come back, but under one condition. Your mind is made up. If I would send your fare, could you pay all your bills? Let me know real soon." Ella believed that Malcolm would be better off under her care, and his older siblings agreed. In early February 1941, 3 months shy of 16, nearly 6 feet tall and still growing, Malcolm boarded the Greyhound bus at Lansing's depot. He took pains to wear his best suit, a dark green. The sleeves stopped some way short of his wrists. He wore a narrow-collared, light green topcoat. 20 hours later, his first major reinvention would begin.